Case under advisement. And we'll move on to the third case, which is Hartmark against Abood.
Good morning, Your Honors, and please the Court. My name is Carter Phillips, and I represent the defendant's appellants in this matter. It is well settled in this circuit and elsewhere that sanctions cannot be affirmed. They are, in fact, an abuse of discretion if the sanction award is based on an incorrect understanding of the underlying law. And it is absolutely clear in this case that Judge Shader, particularly with respect to the decision to sanction my client with respect to having arranged financing, labored on a very serious misapprehension of the law. It comes pretty easily even from the appellee's own brief, and I would ask you to turn to page 32 of the brief. You could also get this at Joint Appendix of 125, where Judge Shader explains what it is that animated his view about the mistake that was made by my clients in connection with the tender offer in this case. He says, having arranged financing talks in the past tense, and it says, either I have got money in the bank, or if I don't have money in the bank, I have essentially the equivalent. That's what having arranged financing means. That's a legal issue. Is that what it means as a matter of law when you're doing a pre-tender offer communication under 14B, 14E?
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, Mr. Phillips, because it seems to me that maybe a way of looking at this case is how formally financing has to be arranged before a statement such as the August 13th letter can issue. And if I understand you from both your brief and your reply brief, your position is that there had been informal discussions and arrangements, that it hadn't been nailed down to actual commitment letters at that point. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. That if you read Spencer Hayes' affidavit at the Joint Appendix, page 651, and on through, he describes in elaborate detail all of the equity investors and the banks with whom he had spoken and from whom he had obtained oral commitments on their part to essentially fund this takeover.
Well, isn't there a difference between arranged financing and financing subject to certain conditions?
No, I think arranged financing could be fairly described in either in both of those terms. I mean, it is possible that arranged financing could mean you have it just precisely the way Judge Shader describes it, you have cash in hand or the equivalent thereof. But that's not the only definition of arranged financing. And if you're going to sanction a party for defending the use of the language arranged financing in a tender offer like this, not even a tender offer, a pre-tender offer communication, it has to be the law that there is only one interpretation of that language. And you will look in vain in anything that Judge Shader wrote or in anything that the appellees have written that remotely suggests that there is only one understanding of the word arranged financing. There's no law on that. And indeed, if you look at the SEC's own statements with respect to the notice and comment, it was very clear when it adopted the newest interpretation of Rule 14E that it didn't mean to set any particular rules with respect to what kind of financing you have to have.
Would you say that the SEC is taking the position that the kind of handshake financing is okay as a predicate to something like, you know, one of these scheduled TO filings and something like the August 13th letter?
Yes, as long as when the time comes you are actually going to make a tender offer, you have the money in place and are ready to go. There's no requirement that you have all of the money lined up and ready before you make this kind of a preliminary statement. And the reason for that was clear. The SEC wanted to get more information out to potential investors earlier. And they were left, and they realized there's some risk of that. But they said the ultimate solution to that problem is when the time comes for making the tender offer, we'll look back and say, did you operate in good faith? Did you have a basis for what you said? And no one can read Spencer Hayes' affidavit in this case and come away with any conclusion other than this is a man who has done these kinds of deals for more than 20 years, has bought apparel companies all over the country, and has done it on exactly the same terms and circumstances that he employed here. He went to his banker, he got the deal lined up, and then he went out and made the release.
How certain does somebody have to be that the mode of acquisition, if you will, is going to be a tender offer before you file the Schedule TO,
the
preliminary, you know,
the SEC's rules describe these things as business combinations, which is exactly the same language we used in our original response to the complaint in this case, and that's a broad term. It can go off in a number of different ways once you begin a set of negotiations, and there's no reason, the SEC has no reason to try to structure how you want to go ahead with the deal. If the parties can work out some other kind of arrangement, that's fine. But at least the investors know early on that there is a serious offer by someone with a serious intent to go forward with a potential tender offer. It may not turn out that way, and indeed in the August 13th press release, it specifically says, you know, we have to get approval of the Hartmarks board, they have to be willing to give up their poison pill, and we have to do some due diligence. It was never, under any circumstances, viewed as categorical.
So do you interpret this press release as a statement that you were hoping to have a friendly transaction as opposed to a hostile tender offer?
Absolutely. There was never any intention to have a hostile tender offer. Indeed, the press release specifically disavows that, saying that it's conditioned on ultimate approval by the board. Our assumption was that this would certainly bring them to the table. It may end up in a tender offer. It may end up with some other kind of business combination. But it was a rebut. But the one thing that's terribly important in that is that at the time they issued the release, they absolutely believed that that if they had to go to a tender offer for $4.50 a share, that they would have the financing. This is exactly how they had done arranged financing in the past. And again, it's terribly important in that context that we're talking about sanctions now. It's not a question of whether we would have violated SEC rules or anything at the end of the day. The question is, could we legitimately defend ourselves, or did we have to fall on our sword in response to our saying we have arranged financing and then Judge Shader saying, no, arranged financing means you have to have cash in hand. And there's not a case that says that. And if you look at the dictionary definitions, they are quite lenient in some respects with respect to that, planning or participation in programs. Nothing that requires the kind of ironclad commitments that Judge Shader describes in his ruling here in this case.
But of course the problem for you, I think, on the other side is that the review is here for abuse of discretion. Judge Shader made a determination that in all the circumstances there had been misleading statements, that people, the market, others had been led to believe that the money was there. And under the circumstances, some or all, I realize one could look at this as a whole or one could go pleading by pleading, but these four pleadings were sanctionable. So don't we need to give his findings some deference?
The reason deference is not appropriate here is because this is all predicated on a fundamental misapprehension of the law. It was his view that you had to have cash or its equivalent as a condition to making this kind of a statement. There is no support in any case that remotely says that. As a consequence of that, we were certainly free to go forward and defend ourselves against a lawsuit brought by the other side under those circumstances. There is nothing to defer to under those circumstances. In addition to which, of course, this is not a case in which he made findings or held a hearing. He simply looked at the papers and made a judgment. Now, in some circumstances, that might be entitled to some form of deference, but in a circumstance here where there is absolutely uncontroverted statements of a clear intention to go ahead with a tender offer if that was the ultimate negotiated solution to this particular problem, there's no basis for being deferential in your review of Judge Shader's opinion under these circumstances. And it's even worse when you get to the back end of this, when you get to the mootness portion of this. I mean, we filed a motion to dismiss for mootness because a 14E claim and a 14E counterclaim, which all require as a condition of anything the existence of a tender offer or a potential tender offer. And what happened on October 1st, we withdrew completely and said we are not having any kind of a tender offer. At that point, there is no longer a dispute among anyone with respect to what to do in terms of these public statements that were out there.
Well,
it's not going
not
to affect the
tender
offer.
That's true, but even Cooter and Gell says the Rule 11 issues can survive the end of litigation.
Right, but the question is, were we entitled to file a motion to dismiss for mootness once the case became moot. And to be sure, we're not saying that there's no basis on which to go back and look to see whether anything we did violated Rule 11, but what we surely were entitled to do when the case was moot was to bring that to the court's attention. Indeed, you could make a pretty solid argument. It would have been almost sanctionable for us not to bring that to the court's attention and to allow this thing to drift on in circumstances where there was a formal withdrawal of any intention to go forward with a tender offer under those circumstances. So that, and again, if all of the case law, I mean, there's not a single case that holds that you should retain jurisdiction over a 14E claim once the tender offer is withdrawn. The plaintiffs have gone to some length to try to distinguish the cases that we rely upon, but they all essentially stand for that very simple-minded proposition, and it's a very straightforward rule. Once you have no dispute with respect to the basis on which federal jurisdiction arises, there's nothing further to fight over. And they make the suggestion that we withdrew our counterclaim because we didn't think it had merit. No, we withdrew our counterclaim for the same reason we moved to dismiss their original claim. Our claim was in federal court was based solely on 14E. Once there was no tender offer in play, that case came to the case came to an end. And then the last portion of what they have discussed here is the motion for judgment on the pleadings that was filed. And that frankly is just an effort at a gotcha here, because there is nothing inconsistent between the first filing that was made by the defendants in this case and the second filing. The first filing talks about business combinations, which is the language the SEC uses to include tender offers. The second pleading specifies that we're talking about ultimately a potential tender offer. At all times, we recognize the possibility of a friendly deal that would take whatever form a friendly deal would take. There's nothing that says that what we attempted to do here was wrong, so long as we were prepared at the right time to come up with the money to cut the deal in order to give a $4.50 per share, and that's precisely what we were prepared to do.
Was the scheduled TO, or actually, I guess eventually there are several of them, but were they before the court at the time you filed your first response, or did you attach them, or in any other way was the fact that you were laying groundwork?
I'm pretty sure the plaintiffs would have attached them to their original complaint.
So the court would have had before it filings that would indicate that tender offer was an avenue.
Yes. And the reality of this is Judge Shader made an immediate leap from day one in this case. He concluded that, if you file on a TO schedule, that means you this is an ironclad, you've got to go immediately. The truth is the rules have changed. The SEC had fundamentally altered the field with respect to how to proceed with the TO. That it had decided that much more information earlier on in the process was the appropriate way to go. He never recognized that fact, and the rest of his analysis in this case essentially followed that from that single mistake. He made two more mistakes as he went along, but that was the first one. At the end of the day, the one thing I want to say about this case, and we're not here about the sanction. This is not a $100,000 case. What this is about is a district judge saying to reputable businessmen that they lied and that they materially misled investors. It is a deeply offensive statement, and it is based on a fundamentally mischaracterized view of the law. And that's why this case is here, and I urge you to reverse, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McDevitt.
May it please the court. The issue with respect to the sanctions motion is not whether Lincoln was entitled to file its offer on a scheduled TO. Judge Shader made no findings on that fact and explicitly said that he could not look into Lincoln's head and determine whether it intended to conduct a tender offer or not. The issue for purposes of the sanctions award is the district court's factual finding that on August 13th, when Lincoln announced its offer, it did not have financing for the offer.
But that's where let me tell you, I have kind of a broad issue about this case that troubles me, but also a specific point. The broad issue that troubles me is how this kind of sanctions order fits into the scheme that Congress has created under all of the securities laws, the Private Securities Litigation Act, the Section 14E of the Exchange Act, et cetera, how it feeds into the dynamics of tender offers, which can often be rather contentious. The specific thing that I worry about is it seems to me, forgetting about whether arrange, what Webster's thinks arrange means or what have you, if a handshake on financing is enough to make that statement arguably correct, as opposed to a signed on the dotted line, you know, open letter of credit from, you know, Chase Manhattan Bank, then the statement may be all right. And then there's sort of an underlying merits issue, you know, what actually does 14E require? But if the first of those questions, how firmly does the financing have to be found, is unclear, then I'm troubled with sanctions. So maybe you could address that, because they did come forward with some evidence that said that there was handshake sort of financing.
Yes, they did. But the issue is their press release misleading, and then based on that...
Oh, I understand that, but if they had financing on a handshake, then is their press release misleading? We've arranged for financing. I sat down with you over lunch, and you said, I'm going to give you $100 million for this financing. I said, great. Then I file my Schedule PO.
Yes, the press release is misleading when you look at that statement in context. They could have easily said, we have oral expressions of interest from banks and venture capitalists, if that's what they intended to convey to the market.
But they could have, but does the word arranged mean, what level of detail of formality does the word arranged connote?
In context here, it connotes that they had the financing in hand.
Why?
As Judge Shader points out in his opinion, you have to read that statement, we have arranged financing, in the context of the entire press release.
The
press release, Lincoln also states that its investors had committed $70 million in equity for the deal.
And
they had not.
Isn't that what they said they were going to do, though?
But they had not committed $70 million in equity. Again, they only had oral expressions.
That gets back to my point. They said they were going to do it. They hadn't finished the paperwork on it. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. You know, I don't know. But
that's not what they said.
Well, they said they had the commitment. They probably thought they did have the commitment.
No, well, the investors themselves said, we have committed $70 million in equity for the transaction.
Right.
They had not. They had not signed any deal.
What does commitment mean, though? I mean, I don't know why an oral commitment isn't a commitment.
Well, I guess to quote Samuel Goldwyn, a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on.
So they're
conveying to the market they have firm financing and equity commitments, and all they had were oral expressions of interest even from their own equity investors.
And so I'm looking for cases that say that that's not enough. And you don't have cases that say that, do you? That the oral expression is not enough.
To say we have arranged financing?
Yes, I know you've got lots of cases that with quotes of... financing has been arranged, or, you know, I mean, there are lots of cases that talk about that in the past tense, in that when you make such a statement, it means there's been actual financing. But the problem here is you don't have anything that says the oral expression is not enough. I mean, and in terms of Judge Shader, he made a specific finding. You know, it was his interpretation of the law, and I'm looking for cases that support that it can't have some other meaning.
Well, Lincoln's argument is that the verb arrange means to plan, one of the meanings is to plan or make preparations for. But as Judge Shader noted, they never come to grips with the fact.
Well, see, I understand what Judge Shader said, but I'm looking for other cases that Judge Shader may have relied on, and I'm not finding any.
Well, that may be true, but I...
So therefore, if there are no cases there, then why couldn't they make that argument? Why couldn't they make that argument, and why are they subject to sanctions?
Because the objective meaning of this statement read in context in connection with the statement that they had, the investors had committed equity, and I'll point out that the headline of the press release stated, Hartmarks received offer of $4.50 per share cash for all of the company's outstanding stock. When you read that all together, the clear impression that's being conveyed to the investing public, and which Lincoln intended to convey, was that it had the cash in hand on August 13th, to purchase Hartmarks at a cash price of $4.50 per share. It did not. And notably, Judge Kokoris in the related securities class action litigation against Lincoln also reads Lincoln's August 13th statement the same way that Judge Shader did. And we have attached that opinion as Exhibit 1 to our Rule 38 motion. But it's quite clear that Judge Kokoris also reads this as saying, we have financing in hand on August 13th. Lincoln did not have financing on hand on August 13th. We allege that they did not have financing on hand on August 13th They denied that allegation. They did not fairly answer our allegation.
They did deny it, but I think the basis of the denial is because they had the oral commitments, and they thought by the time, you know, all of, and I'm sure the Hartmarks board wasn't going to abolish the poison pill in 5 minutes. There's time that goes forward. There were clear conditions expressed to the tender offer in the August 13th statement. It's hard for me to see. This is not a case where no one had ever said a word about where the money was going to come from. That seems to me would be a clearly misleading statement. Instead, we have this gray area, this middle ground of oral commitments but not finalized written commitments.
But they didn't have financing. The point is they admit later on their
Well, in your definition, in terms of finalized written commitments, I absolutely agree with you. They didn't have that. But the question is that what the law requires? And as Judge Williams says, where is the case that says you can't file the Schedule TO and make a reference to commitments unless they take this form that you're talking about?
The issue is not filing the Schedule TO. The issue is that Hartmarks specifically alleged in paragraph 36B of its complaint that Lincoln did not have financing on August 13th. That's a true statement. Lincoln denied that statement and affirmatively alleged that it did have financing. That is not true. That's a violation of Rule 11. Lincoln should have said, we do not have financing commitments, but we have oral arrangements. That's not something that came out until much later in the litigation. And Lincoln tries to move the date forward by arguing in their appeal brief that we shouldn't look at the status of its financing as of August 13th, which should look at the status of its financing as of the time it filed its court filings. But the fact of the matter remains that Lincoln did not have financing on September 13th when it filed its initial pleadings, and it didn't have financing on September 19th when it filed its amended pleadings.
What about the mootness point? I found it extraordinary that you would have gotten sanctions for a motion to dismiss on account of mootness.
Well, Lincoln is not being sanctioned because it filed a motion to dismiss for mootness. We disagree that the case was moot, but that's not the basis for sanctions. Judge Shader found that Lincoln's mootness motion itself was based on misrepresentations and continued to
be. They were dismissing the case because there wasn't a tender offer anymore, and you have this weird theory that the Delaware courts are incapable of conducting litigation on their own as to whether various statements are or are not misleading when they're not bound by a word that's been said in the Northern District of Illinois.
That's not our theory about why sanctions should apply. Sanctions should apply because Lincoln made affirmative misrepresentations in its motion to dismiss the action as moot. It continued to, as Judge Shader
found... Why were they material if the case was moot?
Well, our position is the case is not moot, but
what 14E case do you have that survives the termination of a tender offer?
We have none, but I would point out this. I would say that our argument would be, and this is on the merits, not on the sanctions issue, that you cannot attempt to withdraw a tender offer through another false and misleading statement, because that false and misleading statement is also in connection with a tender offer.
That's incredible. So you can't even back out of a tender offer. You're sort of forced to keep the tender offer open forever, under your view.
No, until you grant the relief that was requested, which was corrective disclosure.
Why? I mean, if you want to say, look, I'm sorry we even thought of the whole thing, we're folding up our tent and going home, it's your view you can't do that?
You can't do that without making a corrective disclosure.
Why?
Because they're misleading the market.
The market now knows that there's no tender offer from the Lincoln Group and its associated people vis-a-vis Hartmarks. What else does the market need to know?
The market needs to know that Lincoln never had the financing to go forward with
the
offer.
Why is that material?
Because the market still believes that Lincoln could make an offer.
Lincoln could have paid $100 a share if it's not going to do it anymore. What interest is it of yours if there's some future target?
But
I suppose they might want
to
know.
Actually, this goes to the merits, and certainly withdrawing.
No, it goes to whether that was a sanctionable filing, too.
Right, but whether or not the case was moot at that point, it certainly doesn't exonerate Lincoln's earlier Rule 11 violations. You certainly cannot file a series of court filings that violate Rule 11 and then avoid all consequences by withdrawing your offer and moving to dismiss the action as moot.
But of course, as you've pointed out, we evaluate this pleading by pleading, and maybe that last pleading was not properly the subject of sanctions, even if other pleadings might have been.
And if you were to conclude that, I looked at this and there's approximately 14,000 of our $99,000 sanctions award that related to our cost of opposing the mootness motion. And I would point out in that context that Lincoln has continued its pattern of deception on appeal by representing that we were awarded all of our costs, fees and costs in the underlying action. That's clearly incorrect. Judge Shader awarded only 41% and found that we had been meticulous in asking, detailing our sanctions motion, and that Hartmark had asked for no attorney time that did not have an appropriate hook to a Rule 11 violation.
Right, but you mentioned in your own brief, I don't see that this isn't part of ordinary briefing. You say on page 2 of your brief that the overall expenses were $241,507. It's before the court. They don't contest that in their reply brief. They note again that it's been $99,264, whatever it is.
Right, but they do affirmatively represent that the court awarded Hartmark almost its entire fees and costs in the litigation. That's not true. We were awarded only a portion of our fees.
Let me just move to a different topic. In terms of Hartmark's due diligence, did you comply with the Booth due diligence request and confidentiality request?
Hartmark was in constant communication with Lincoln. Lincoln would not provide its financing documents. It said that its offer was subject to limited due diligence. It propounded an extremely broad due diligence request that would have required Hartmark to produce documents for every one of its subsidiaries, 107 categories of documents for every one of its subsidiaries for a 7-year period. That's not limited due diligence.
Any negotiations over limiting the scope of that request?
Yes, there were. Yes. But Lincoln adamantly refused to provide Hartmark with copies of its financing documents because it didn't want the Hartmark board to find out at that point, and it didn't want the market to know, is it had not arranged financing, as it has said. Its financing was totally illusory at that point. In fact, it never had financing. And the most telling aspect of that is Lincoln's own September 19th press release, where it categorizes its so-called financing commitments from Bank of America and Stevens as mere proposals. And the reason it had to do that, it knew it couldn't say in a public press release that was going to be read by Bank of America and Stevens that they had now committed to finance this deal when they hadn't. So Lincoln knew it couldn't say that in its own public press release. It's admitting that all it has and all it ever had were proposals. That's not what it told the market. I would request that the court affirm the district court's judgment, and we also request that Hartmark be awarded its fees and costs in this appeal in defending its sanctions award. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. You have 2 minutes, Mr. Phillips.
Let me start by focusing on the SEC's language that talks about what you have to do in connection with the TO schedule. This is not intended, this is at 64 Federal Register 61417. This is not intended, footnote 93, intended to change how bidders legitimately finance their offers today. Bidders may have sufficient funds on hand to complete the offer, or they may arrange to borrow funds from an outside source. In most cases, when the bidder expects to obtain funds from another source, financing is arranged in advance or immediately after announcing an offer. But that's typically so. But there's nothing there that remotely says that you always have to have everything in writing, nailed down at the moment that you show up in the market. And there is no case, and there is no case with respect to the mootness aspects of this decision. With respect to Judge Koukouras, All he did there was deny a motion to dismiss a portion of the complaint. He granted a portion of the motion to dismiss. Doesn't remotely support anything with respect to this case at this stage, because the circumstances are exactly the opposite. All inferences are in their favor. In this context, where everything is based on a fundamental error of law, then the inferences, there is no deference, and the court should reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.